Previously on the Devil's Teeth podcast.
We don't know if she was killed or was a drug overdose or just a heart attack. We'll never know.
Fatty that worked at the Walker's Fork Golf Club was living in the woods.
This guy lived in the woods where her body was found.
He was known as Walker's Fork Red.
When her body was found, he wasn't there anymore.
The Springfield Police Department put significant effort into trying to locate this individual. And out of all this effort, the man was identified.
Do you know if they brought him into the police department for questioning?
I know he was questioned. He was spoken to, but he's no longer a viable suspect.
She was young and she was beautiful, smart and caring, gifted and loyal. Joan Kramer was everything a person could want in a friend, confidant, or sibling. But on the evening of August 15th, 1972, it all came to a terrible end. Born February 20th, 1948, Joan Leslie Kramer was, along with her twin sister Sari, the youngest child of Ruth and Julian Kramer. Joan, Sari, and their older brother Oren all enjoyed a comfortable childhood thanks to Julian's work as the owner and president of Suburban Foods Incorporated and the Tantliff Beef Company. Even as a toddler, Joan showed great promise. By the time she was 4 years old, she had already learned to read. Only a few years later, she could be found devouring classic works like War and Peace by the glow of a nearby flashlight late into the evening. But behind the precociousness, there was trauma and tragedy. By the time she grew into adolescence, Joan Kramer had faced a series of invasive surgeries, ranging from having all her baby teeth pulled at once to the removal of a bone tumor on her spine. Most jarring of all, however, was Joan's eventual diagnosis with lupus, a life-threatening disease causing healthy tissue to be attacked by antibodies when she was only 15 years old. By the time she was a senior in high school, Joan required daily doses of cortisone to function. Her breathing was often troubled, with the smallest cough leaving her in agony, and she sometimes resorted to sleeping while sitting up to avoid the pain of lying down. In one of her notebooks, Joan once wrote, "Forgive, O my Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy big one on me." However, Joan refused to let her condition become a death sentence, and began living her life to the fullest. So much so, in fact, most people around her weren't even aware of her affliction with the disease. Her gregarious nature refused to reveal any hint of ill health. Lupus, however, would not be responsible for the demise of Joan Kramer. On the night of August 15th, 1972, only 8 days after Jeanette DePalma disappeared, Joan Kramer, now a 24-year-old graduate student at Columbia University, was back home in South Orange, New Jersey, visiting her family on Crest Drive. At some point during the evening, Joan and her fiancé, Bernard Davidoff, began to argue. Incensed, she left her parents' home, intent on walking off her stress. Clad in a beautiful orange and white evening dress, a blue velvet jacket, and a pearl necklace, Joan made the 1 mile journey from Crest Drive to downtown South Orange. She walked down a dark alley behind the village drugstore and into a small payphone booth littered with glassine bags and hypodermic needles. There, she called Brooke Harris, a friend in New York, and vented about the fight. Curiously, when asked where she had walked off to, Joan told Brooke that she was, quote, on a deserted street in Newark. Being only a mile away from her childhood home, Joan almost certainly knew where she was. However, her motives for misleading her friend would be taken to the grave. After assuring Brooke she would return home soon, Joan hung up and walked across the street to a cab stand, where she planned to hail a taxi. For reasons that remain unknown, Joan Kramer soon left the cab stand and approached a car waiting at the traffic light on the corner of South Orange Avenue and Sloane Street. There, she asked the motorist for a ride home. She was never seen alive again. When Joan failed to return home that night, her family contacted the police. As was the case with the DePalmas, the Kramers were told they would have to wait a further 24 hours before anything could be done. Unlike Jeanette's vanishing, however, the South Orange police took action as soon as that period had ended, albeit in a very limited fashion. The South Orange Police Department refused to treat Joan's disappearance as a kidnapping or possible homicide, and chose to consider it a missing persons case. Also, unlike Jeanette, the national press immediately took an interest in Joan's disappearance. most likely due to her father's social and financial stature. Articles were published in newspapers around the country, featuring photos of Joan and details regarding her family's prominence and the last night she was seen. These articles almost certainly led to the barrage of bizarre phone calls Julian Kramer began to receive 3 days after his daughter vanished. Using an accent described as being either, quote, Indian or West African, an anonymous man claimed he had kidnapped Joan and demanded $17,000 for her safe return. When Julian asked the caller for proof of his story, he heard the muffled scream of a woman in the background. Startled, he collected the cash and arranged to drop off the ransom, the first of three attempts to do so. Each time, Julian left the money in a prearranged location, only to have the supposed kidnapper call back, insisting he had not received the ransom. After the third attempt, the mysterious man said he was going to kill Joan and hung up, never to call again. Despite these strange phone calls, the South Orange Police Department still refused to step up their investigation. This changed, however, once the department received a call from the FBI asking, "What's this we hear about a ransom?" Spurred on by this sudden burst of federal attention, the police began searching South Orange Village and the nearby South Mountain Reservation for clues. Unfortunately, these searches proved to be fruitless. It wasn't until the morning of Monday, August 28th, that Joan Kramer's body was finally found, but not by the police. Instead, her nude and decomposing body was discovered by two teenage boys walking along a footpath inside Union Township's Elizabeth River Park. She had been left along the edge of a tributary. Most of her clothing was found a short distance away. For those paying attention, the similarities between this murder and Jeanette De Palma's should have been immediately noticeable. Joan had disappeared 8 days after Jeanette. She, just like Jeanette, was found lying face down in a wooded area of Union County, only 6 miles away from the Devil's Teeth Cliff inside the Hoodai Quarry. An autopsy later revealed that Joan had been murdered via strangulation, Jeanette De Palma's suspected cause of death. Both Joan and Jeanette were petite young women with slender builds, and both wore their long, straight brown hair parted in the middle. And finally, while most of Joan's clothing was recovered, a few things were never found. Her shoes and her necklace. Jeanette De Palma also had a necklace taken from her when she was killed. Despite these glaring similarities, few were aware of them. Back in 2014, when Mark Moran and I interviewed Don Schwert, the Springfield patrol officer who found Jeanette's body, he told us he had never even heard of the Kramer murder case until that day.
There was another high-profile missing girl case that occurred the same week that Jeanette went missing over in South Orange. Joan Kramer, another young woman that disappeared while hitchhiking. Were you aware of this other case that was happening at the Harrell Times?
No. I have no idea of that. That's the first I've heard of it. You telling me now.
And like Don Schwert, Ed Kish denies ever hearing about Joan Kramer as well.
Let me switch gears here and ask you about other murders in the area at the time. Joan Kramer, a young girl similar in age to Jeanette. Do you have any recollection of the police trying to make a correlation between the two girls? Does that name ring a bell to you?
No, it does not.
One person who did see the similarities was Michael Mitzner, the assistant Union County prosecutor at the time. Mitzner and his office eventually set up a telephone tip line solely devoted to Jeanette and Joan due to the apparent connections between the two murders. Unfortunately, nothing of merit was ever called in. After all, there were no mysterious transient caddies living in Elizabeth River Park for the locals to pin the girl's death on. And for some strange reason, perhaps due to the stories about ransom demands from an ostensibly foreign kidnapper, the press never tagged an occult angle onto Joan's case when Jeanette's body was later found. Sure, the lack of satanic objects around Joan's body helped this, but with so many other similarities between the two murders in such a short amount of time, it does lead one to wonder why the press seemed hesitant to investigate a possible connection even further. Either way, the kidnapping theory soon evaporated after Joan's autopsy revealed she had been killed within a matter of mere hours after leaving the dinner party. The undigested food in her stomach made this obvious. Whoever had called Julian Kramer and pretended to be a foreign kidnapper and a bound and gagged Joan was little more than a disgusting opportunist. With this lead gone, there would be no developments in the Kramer case for over a year. On May 14, 1973, 45-year-old Renee Calley and her pregnant daughter, 24-year-old Leslie Grant, were found hanged in the basement of their Upper Montclair home, only 8 miles away from South Orange. At first, police suspected a double suicide, but at the urging of Callie's husband, John, detectives began to investigate a 26-year-old window washer named Robert Del Petrarca. Callie's reasoning? Two simple, yet horrifying facts. One, Petrarca had been to his home to clean windows only a day before the bodies were found. And two, the man was currently sitting in an Essex County jail facing attempted murder charges for trying to strangle an 83-year-old woman named Lillian Schlintz inside her South Orange home. Once Petrarca was formally charged with the murders of Renee Calley and Leslie Grant, South Orange investigators took notice of his M.O., strangulation. As a matter of formality, the department investigated Petrarca as a suspect in Joan Kramer's murder, but that soon fizzled out. However, less than a week later, another suspect was announced to the media, a 34-year-old rapist named Robert L. DeNike. Like Petrarca, DeNike was initially considered a suspect due to his previous crimes. In this case, kidnapping and raping a Westfield woman in 1972, and being accused of raping a college student in Union during the winter of 1971. DeNike was administered a polygraph test regarding his possible involvement in the death of Joan Kramer, and according to several law enforcement sources, he either flunked the test or it was rendered inconclusive. This, however, was enough for the detectives to search his car. There, they found the backing from a woman's earring, a handkerchief marked with the letter K, and a map of South Orange. In addition to this damning evidence, DeNike also lived on Brook Fall Avenue in Union, less than half a mile from where Joan's body was found. Despite these compelling facts, the evidence against DeNike was only considered circumstantial, and he never faced charges in the murder of Joan Kramer. Unsurprisingly, even more questions remain. If the prosecutor's office believed the De Palma and Kramer cases to be related, and later publicly stated that one of these men could have been Joan Kramer's murderer, is it then reasonable to wonder if one of them could have also killed Jeanette De Palma? Did the investigators ever chase down this lead as well? We may never know the truth. When I requested a copy of the Joan Kramer case file from the Essex County Prosecutor's Office back in 2014, I received a reply stating that while they had conducted a, quote, exhaustive search of multiple storage facilities, the records department could not find Joan's file, and it is now presumed lost or destroyed. In any case, the Petrarca and DeNike connections eventually faded into obscurity, thanks to the eventual arrest of a troubled accountant who had been suspected of murdering young women in his South Orange neighborhood for years. A man we will discuss in the next episode of the Devil's Teeth podcast. Special thanks to Mark Moran, Mark Skierman, Rusty and Christina from Antiquity Echoes, Don Schwert, Ed Kish, Oren Kramer, Dr. Sari Kramer, Marjorie Lang Sportis, Michael Mitzner, Neil Cooper, and Weird New Jersey's Cult of the Letter Senders. Follow us at Devil's Teeth Pod on Twitter.